Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 169. It's Monday, June 27th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get right to it. Abortions in Ohio are now illegal. This from Cincinnati.com. Ohio's six-week abortion ban becomes law hours after Supreme Court's Dobbs decision. Abortions in Ohio are now illegal once a fetal heartbeat can be detected. The news came Friday evening in the form of a ruling from a federal court judge who lifted the nearly three-year injunction on the law following the U.S. Supreme Court's reversal of Roe v. Wade on Friday morning. Judge Michael Barrett granted the state's request to lift an injunction in place since 2019. What does Ohio's new six-week abortion law mean for the state? Dubbed the Heartbeat Bill, the law criminalizes all abortions performed after the detection of fetal cardiac activity, which is about 6 weeks into pregnancy. That's 4 weeks after conception. So, editorial note, please note that pregnancies are measured from a woman's last menstrual period, not from the time of conception. So when they say 6 weeks, it's actually 4 weeks into the actual biological pregnancy. Patients seeking what would now be illegal abortions would not be prosecuted under this new law, but providers could face fifth-degree felony charges and up to 1 year in prison. The law has an exception to save the life of a patient, but no exceptions for rape or incest. Kelly Copeland, executive director of Pro-Choice Ohio, said the injunction was lifted much quicker than anticipated. "We thought we had weeks," Copeland said. "This is much faster than anyone anticipated." She recommended patients seeking abortions contact clinics to get instructions on next steps, which might include going to another state. She said groups like Women Have Options provide money and assistance for those seeking abortions. And for you folks in the Toledo area, you can seek out the AggieFund.org. The AggieFund.org, which provides money and assistance for those seeking abortions. If you don't need an abortion and would like to help people out, you can donate funds there to that nonprofit. Well, as the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, here's an excerpt from some of the statement from the Guttmacher Institute, which works for abortion rights. "The U.S. Supreme Court has taken the radical step of overturning Roe v. Wade outright, thus unleashing uncertainty and harm onto people asking for nothing more than to exercise their fundamental right to bodily autonomy. Without Roe, 26 states are certain or likely to ban abortion to the fullest extent possible, including 13 states that have trigger laws in place that will automatically enact bans, some within days or even hours of Friday's decision. Decades of research consistently show that abortion bans and restrictions don't reduce unintended pregnancy or demand for abortion, and they certainly do not help people improve their health. Rather, they impose significant hurdles to obtaining care, causing stress for people in need of abortion, and leading some to experience forced pregnancy and all its troubling consequences. Evidence also shows that disproportionate and unequal impact abortion restrictions have on people who are already marginalized and oppressed, including black and brown communities, other people of color, people with low incomes, young people, LGBT communities, immigrants, and people with disabilities. This decision comes when the need for abortion is actually growing in the United States. The 930,000 abortions obtained across the country in 2020 represent the first sustained increase in abortion in almost 3 decades, and more than 1 in 3 of these abortions were obtained in states that are now certain or likely to ban abortion. Okay, well, let's drill down a little bit and look at what this means for Ohio. In Ohio, in the most recent year, 2020, which birth and abortion data is available, there were 129,000 live births, 21,000 abortions. If, as I reported last week, if abortions are reduced by about one quarter, and those abortions would result in a live birth, then Ohio can expect over 5,000 unwanted babies. In Lucas County, this would be over 200. This would be about a 4% increase in the birth rate. Of course, the larger increase would be in the proportion of babies born who are unwanted. About 1% of women and girls age 14 to 44, those of reproductive age, have an abortion in any given year. The Physicians for National Health Program estimates that maternal mortality will increase up to 15% overall and up to 33% for people of color. It's no coincidence that after decades of improvement, American maternal mortality rates started going up at the same time that many states began restricting access to abortion. Today, the rate of pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S. is nearly tripled compared to 30 years ago, with black women nearly 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy and childbirth than whites. Black women are also more than 3 times more likely to have an abortion than white women. Also, I'd like to just add one of the things that, I mean, the Supreme Court, the newest justice, Amy Coney Barrett, in arguments over the Roe v. Wade overturnal decisions of Dobbs, in the arguments, she referenced adoptions and how that can solve the problem by just putting babies up for adoption. So let's take a little bit of look at that. So in the United States annually, there are roughly 115,000 domestic adoptions. There are about 122,000 children that are waiting in foster care for adoption. And the average wait for a child to be placed in a home was 31 months in 2019. And of course, that's for the children that find a placement. A lot of kids, older kids, end up aging out of the system and are never adopted. Okay, well, as H.L. Mencken infamously stated, to every complex problem, there's a simple solution that is wrong. And the idea that women can just have a baby and put it up for adoption is one of those overly simple solutions. So how does this actually work in the world? This from the Texas Tribune. Texas has a law that allows parents to give up newborns at fire stations or hospitals. Hardly anyone uses it. The idea behind Texas's safe haven law is simple. Any parent can bring their baby who is less than 60 days old to a fire station, hospital, or EMS station and hand it over. No questions asked. If the baby is unharmed, parents face no criminal charges, and the Department of Family and Protective Services takes custody. But in Texas, the law is rarely utilized. Just 172 infants have been relinquished under the Safe Haven law since 2009. That's 2009. That's 13 years ago. 13 years, 172 infants. According to the data from the Department of Family and Protective Services, 21 babies were surrendered under the law in 2020, the most in 1 year during that time span. 7 infants have been relinquished so far this year. And of course, this whole year has been under, in practice, a complete ban of abortion. So these so-called safe haven laws don't really work. Okay, well, another story from the world that we really live in. A public health worker under attack in Ohio here. This from the Washington Post. Ohio health agency staff were fired after abortion pill mentioned in newsletter. When she came across a training opportunity for mifepristone, a drug used in early pregnancy loss and abortions, Jessica Warner put a mention of it in the May edition of the newsletter she compiled as a coordinator at the Ohio Department of Health. An hour after she hit send, her supervisor called. It was the start of an ordeal that culminated in Warner, a sexually transmitted infections and viral hepatitis training coordinator, being fired and 2 other employees disciplined. An investigative report prepared by Human Resources described abortion topics as, quote, off limits, adding that The mifepristone item in the newsletter is in direct conflict with the agency's mission and is an embarrassment to ODH. It also said the topic was contrary to the state's mission. That a state health department would take such a stance, Warner said, came as a shock. I want people to understand how it seems like politics is taking over healthcare, and it's less about the science and the evidence, she said in an interview with the Washington Post 5 days after her termination. And it seems more it's about people who have no background in healthcare who are making our decisions and even censoring and silencing us. Ohio Department of Health spokesman Ken Gordon said there is no policy that keeps abortion topics off limits. He said references to abortion as being in conflict with the health department's mission are based on a state law that took effect in 2019, barring the department from contracting or affiliating with, quote, any entity that performs or promotes non-therapeutic abortions. Warner's supervisor received a suspension, and her supervisor's supervisor resigned, according to the Ohio Capital Journal, which was first to report the incident. The fallout comes as the nation braces for the potential reversal of Roe v. Wade. This was written prior to last Friday. The landmark Supreme Court ruling that enshrined a right to abortion across the United States. Gone. The Capital Journal reported that two bipartisan leaders in the Ohio House Health Committee, along with lobbyists on both sides of the issue, were unaware the agency had a formal stance. The newsletter was sent to about 400 subscribers, including local health departments and community organizations. Most of them were involved in the HIV and sexually transmitted infection work and in public health. It included resources, program updates, and information on sexually transmitted infection cases and rates in Ohio. The investigative report shared with the Post by Warner and the health department flagged newsletter content beyond the abortion pill, mentions of National Masturbation Month, LGBT Elders Day, International Day Against Homophobia, Pansexual and Panromantic Visibility Day, SLAM, which is Sexuality Liberators and Movers, and an event titled Black and Blue, Suicide in Our Own Leather, Kink, and Queer Communities, and, last but not least, National Condom Month. Warner, hired in 2019, argued that the department could not focus on reduction in sexually transmitted infections without acknowledging sexuality. She said research shows a more positive approach is more effective than a risk focus, and noted Ohio's experiencing rising cases of syphilis and other sexually transmitted infections. Warner was, quote, unapologetic when interviewed by Human Resources, the report said. She told investigators the health department was banned from working with Planned Parenthood, quote, because it seems politicians' ignorance and opinions get in the way of providing access to necessary health care for Ohioans. Asked whether the topic of mifepristone went against the mission of the state and health department, she responded, quote, I would hope not. It is a public health issue, and as public health workers, it would be counterproductive to ODH's mission to not support health care initiatives. She told the Post she plans to fight her firing. Okay, well, I have a whole bunch more stories in the bonus article section that you can read online about the abortion battle. Just one more public health battle to ramp up. So you can get that at the end of the show with the links of how to access those articles. Well, the Supreme Court has been busy. And the day before the Roe v. Wade striking down, the Supreme Court ruled on striking down a New York gun law, which is leading to expanded carrying of firearms in public places. So here's a response from the American Medical Association as reported by the Associated Press. The American Medical Association has called the ruling a harmful and deeply disturbing decision. Firearm violence is a public health crisis, and easier access to weapons and fewer restrictions on who carry them and where they can be carried are dangerous steps in the wrong direction. Dr. Jack Resnick, the AMA's president, said in a written statement, overturning decades of reasonable firearm regulations will cost more lives. One big concern is the ability of people to carry guns in public spaces such as neighborhoods, streets, and subways. Paige Graves, the Metropolitan Transit Authority's general counsel, said in a statement, the presence of guns within a sensitive place like New York's transit system is an unacceptable risk. Considering this Supreme Court decision, we have begun drafting appropriate rules to keep dangerous weapons out of our subways, buses, and commuter trains. Officials in the nation's most populous city immediately began reviewing its gun permit application process and pondering how they might legally define, quote, sensitive locations where civilians wouldn't be allowed to bring guns. There's no place in the nation that this decision affects as much as New York City, Mayor Eric Adams said at a news conference, and we are prepared to set an example that will lead the country as to how we do fight back on this decision. Adams, a Democrat and former police captain, raised the specter of everyday disputes turning into shootouts in New York's crowded streets and subways. He suggested that police officers would face greater danger, as well as a greater burden of distinguishing between legal and illegal guns in public places. Come on, folks, especially you law and order types. When the police are against something, shouldn't that be a red flag? Well, and some better news on gun safety, this from the New York Times. Here's what's in the Senate's gun bill and what was left out. The Senate last Thursday passed a bipartisan bill aimed at keeping guns out of the hands of dangerous people, the product of a compromise that could bring about the most substantial gun safety legislation in decades. The Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, written by a small group of Republicans and Democrats in the aftermath of back-to-back mass shootings, would enhance background checks for gun buyers between 18 and 21 years old, incentivize states to enact, quote, red flag laws that enable firearms to be temporarily confiscated from people deemed dangerous, and provide hundreds of millions of dollars for mental health and school safety. It would also extend to dating partners a federal law that prohibits domestic abusers from purchasing guns. Enhanced background checks for younger gun buyers. Juvenile records, including those regarding mental health, would for the first time be required in criminal background checks for prospective gun buyers under the age of 21, and authorities would have more time to conduct the checks, up 10 days from the current 3. Under the legislation, federal authorities would have to check with local law enforcement and review state records to determine if a prospective buyer has a juvenile criminal or mental health history that would disqualify them from purchasing a gun. If they found such a record, they would turn it over to the FBI for further investigation. What was left out? The proposal falls far short of legislation that has passed the House that would ban anyone under the age of 21 from buying a semi-automatic weapon. Democrats also agreed to allow the enhanced background check requirement for younger buyers to expire after 10 years, leaving future Congresses to haggle over whether it should be extended. A similar sunset provision allowed the federal assault bans weapon enacted in 1994 to lapse in 2004, to the dismay of Democrats, who have never been able to muster enough support to revive it. And there is a limit on how long authorities would be able to reach back into a buyer's mental health history. Such records from before a potential buyer turned 16 could not disqualify them from buying a gun. Incentives for states to implement red flag laws. The bill would provide $750 million in federal money for states that create so-called red flag laws, which allows guns to be temporarily confiscated from people deemed dangerous by a judge. The finding, meant to incentivize the enactment of such measures, would also support the creation of crisis intervention court programs. What was left out? Democrats wanted to go further than providing incentives to states and actually enact a federal red flag measure passed in the House that would allow guns to be taken away from anyone deemed by a federal judge to be dangerous. Closing the so-called boyfriend loophole. One of the bill's last sticking points was a provision to toughen federal law to keep guns out of the hand of domestic abusers. It would expand current law that bars people convicted of domestic violence or subject to a domestic violence restraining order from buying a gun. The current law applies only to the people who are married to or lived with the victim or had a child with them. The legislation would now include other intimate partners, closing what has come to be known as the boyfriend loophole. What was left out? Democrats wanted a blanket prohibition, but in negotiations with Republicans, they agreed to allow some offenders to regain the ability to purchase a gun. If a person is a first-time offender and the crime is a violent misdemeanor, the ban would disappear 5 years after the end of their criminal sentence, so long as they did not commit further violent crimes. Negotiators also agreed not to make the provision retroactive, bowing to another demand by Republicans. So it doesn't affect people who have had violations so far. This is not going to really make a difference until, you know, months and years into this. Okay, next up, funding for mental health and school safety. The bill would allocate billions of dollars to schools and communities for expanding mental health programs. The funding also aims to boost school safety. The bill grants $300 million over 5 years for school safety programs targeting violence that would fund school resource officers and beef up security in schools. In addition, funding would go to training school personnel and adults who interact with minors to respond to mental health issues. What is left out? Republicans insisted on keeping the cost of the bill as low as possible. In total, the measure would cost $13.2 billion. Tougher penalties on illegal purchases. The bill would crack down on straw purchasers or people who buy guns for those who would not qualify. No current law specifically prohibits these purchasers or illegal gun trafficking. So prosecutors have relied on people who make false statements in connection with purchasing a gun. The bill would establish a penalty of up to 15 years in prison or 25 years if the firearms are used in connection with a serious criminal activity like drug trafficking or terrorism. It would also provide resources to help prevent and investigate these purchases. What was left out? The bill does not include more sweeping measures to impose universal background checks or ban the sale of large capacity magazines. Republicans also said they refuse to consider any mandatory waiting period for gun sales or a license requirement to purchase an assault weapon. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT We Act Radio, 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's move on to another major public health battle. That is tobacco. This from Axios. Juul decision triggers broader tobacco fight. The FDA's decision to order Juul e-cigarette products off the U.S. market opens a new and grinding battle in the push to revamp government rules for smoking and vaping. The big picture. With parallel efforts to cap nicotine in cigarettes and ban menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars, the Biden administration is pursuing a broad tobacco agenda not seen since the Clinton administration. Yes, but it could be a drawn-out and costly fight. Hours after the FDA issued its marketing denial order on Thursday, Juul said it would seek a stay and was exploring a possible appeal. That stay was granted and will require further hearings. The FDA on Thursday said Juul's marketing application didn't have enough evidence to show the sale of the company's products would be appropriate for the protection of public health. FDA Commissioner Robert Califf said Juul products may have played a, quote, disproportionate role in the rise of youth vaping. Public health groups like the American Heart Association said the decision marks a dramatic step to discourage youth smoking. The popularity of the company's products led a new generation of teens to get hooked on smoking, driven by fruit and mint-flavored cartridges that fit in small vaping devices, research in the journal Pediatrics showed. The burst in youth vaping led the FDA to ban most flavored cartridges in a bid to cut off an alternative nicotine source. The road ahead. The FDA has authorized 23 e-cigarette products and continues to work through a slew of pending applications. These include numerous bottled vaping liquids sold to adults in different flavors and nicotine strengths. The agency has rejected applications for close to 1 million products, but last October granted tobacco giant R.J. Reynolds permission to sell three of its Vuse vaping products. The bottom line? Anti-tobacco advocates say Thursday's decision didn't address the continued role of flavored e-cigarettes, including menthol-flavored products, in sustaining youth e-cigarette use. These remain critical issues requiring FDA to deny marketing applications for all flavored e-cigarettes, including all menthol-flavored products and the flavored disposable products like Puff Bar that have become so popular with kids, said Matthew Myers, president for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. But the decision could still ease some pressure on the agency from Democrats in Congress, who would accuse the FDA of moving too slowly and giving big tobacco companies a free pass. And in an even much bigger tobacco story, this from the Washington Post, Biden administration says it plans to cut nicotine in cigarettes. The Biden administration said it plans to develop a rule requiring tobacco companies to reduce nicotine levels in cigarettes sold in the United States to minimally or non-addictive levels in an effort that, if successful, could have an unprecedented effect in slashing smoking-related deaths and threaten a politically powerful industry. The initiative was included in the administration's Unified Agenda, a compilation of planned federal regulatory actions released twice a year. The Spring Agenda was released last Tuesday. The administration noticed that the Food and Drug Administration intends by May 2023 to develop a proposed standard that would establish a maximum nicotine level in cigarettes and certain finished tobacco products. In a statement released late last Tuesday, the FDA said the goal is to reduce youth use, addiction, and death. If nicotine were reduced, many addicted users would have a greater ability to quit, and young people could be prevented from becoming regular smokers, the agency said. The administration also said a nicotine reduction requirement could advance health equity by addressing disparities associated with cigarette smoking, dependence, and cessation. The policy would fit a major goal of the White House to cut cancer deaths. As part of the White House's retooled cancer moonshot announced this year, President Biden promised to reduce cancer deaths by 50% over 25 years. About 480,000 Americans die of smoking-related causes each year, and tobacco use remains the number one cause of preventable death in the United States. The decision to pursue a policy to lower nicotine levels marks the first step in the lengthy process, and success is not assured. It could take at least a year for the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates cigarettes, to issue a proposed rule, experts say. After that, the FDA would have to sift through comments from the public before issuing a final rule. Opposition could delay or derail the effort, especially if the regulation is not completed before Biden leaves office. Another president elected in 2024 could tell the FDA to stop work on an unfinished rule. The tobacco industry, which is sure to be fiercely opposed to such a drastic change in its products, could challenge a final regulation in court. Supporters say slashing nicotine, the addictive ingredient in cigarettes, would be a milestone in public health that would save millions of lives over generations. In another significant move to reduce smoking-related deaths, the FDA in April proposed banning menthol cigarettes, the only flavored cigarettes still permitted. Matthew Myers, the president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, an anti-smoking group, said slashing nicotine levels would, quote, produce the greatest drop in cancer rates and make the biggest difference of any public health measure under discussion by the administration. The American Heart Association praised the step by calling it one of the most consequential actions the FDA could take to challenge the deadly trajectory of tobacco use in this country. And if you're an Ohioan who's a smoker, who's interested in quitting, you can call the Ohio Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW and get free resources and counseling to quit smoking. Okay, well, in pollution story of another kind, this from the San Francisco Chronicle, California ranks worst in nation for air pollution because of wildfire smoke. A new report finds that California was home to 19 of the 20 worst counties in the nation for particulate pollution in 2020. If sustained, these pollution levels could shave months, if not years, off the lives of residents, according to the Air Quality Life Index, published this month by the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago. Mariposa County in the Sierra foothills recorded the nation's highest concentration of particulate matter, with the average life expectancy estimated to drop by 1.7 years if the pollutants persist. In California, wildfire smoke largely offset the air quality benefits that came with reduced industrial operations and fewer cars on the road. While the report does not track the source of particulate matter, prior studies have shown that fire has become an increasing culprit, especially as state air regulators have made major inroads in cutting transportation pollutants, winning on one front, losing on another. Okay, well, in other state-related news, this from Axios, Colorado bets on a public option to grow health coverage. Colorado is reviving an old progressive health care goal with a new twist, creating a public health insurance option that could be a model for other states trying to expand affordable care as they move past the pandemic. Why it matters? Using flexibilities the Biden administration granted on last Thursday, the state is trying to prove a government-run health plan can attract more consumers and save money while avoiding the political pitfalls associated with single-payer systems. Colorado became the first state to get a federal waiver to create a plan called the Colorado Option that will be offered on the state's Affordable Care Act exchange starting in 2023. The plan would compete with private plans on the exchange with premiums that are on average 22.3% lower. That's projected to save the federal government $214 million in spending on premium tax credit subsidies next year. Colorado would also expand a state subsidy program to lower costs for people who aren't eligible for ACA subsidies. An estimated 32,000 Colorado residents would gain coverage through the option by 2027 when the waiver expires. Washington State is the only state with a public option, but Nevada, Oregon, and Connecticut are weighing whether to follow suit.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure health care for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
And in more news that are, the American healthcare system is neither healthy, caring, nor a system as costly and inefficient. This from MedPage Today. How much do health disparities actually cost? Health inequities in the U.S. currently cost $320 billion annually and could balloon to $1 trillion by 2040 as the population becomes less white, per capita spending increases, and Medicaid enrollment grows, according to a new report by consulting giant Deloitte. To calculate how much health inequities cost now and to extrapolate their financial toll in the future, the company focused on disparities in health outcomes that arise due to a patient's gender, race, or socioeconomic status in multiple populations affected by inequity in various disease states. For example, black adults are 60% more likely to be diagnosed with diabetes than white adults, and 2 to 3 times more likely to experience complications, such as amputation and end-stage renal disease. The researchers found that almost 5% of spending on diabetes is associated with this particular disparity, resulting in $15 billion in unnecessary spending. The researchers also conducted literature reviews among studies with data on disparities in various populations to understand the metrics for additional disease states, such as asthma, heart disease, breast cancer, and colorectal cancer. The actuaries were conservative in their estimates of costs, according to the report. In reality, the cost of inaction on health inequity may be much higher, since the actuaries couldn't account for how every disease might impact another and affect health spending. Deloitte also didn't factor in social determinants of health, like housing, education, food, and physical environment, which have an enormous impact on health outcomes and spending. Chief among social determinants of health are economic disparities. Without addressing poverty and what it does to health and health and the well-being of those who live in it, we will never fully address health inequities or their potential costs to society. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM. Okay, well, next up, going to switch gears a little bit. This from Reuters. CDC confirms evidence of local monkeypox transmission. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said there was evidence of local transmission of monkeypox in addition to reports of cases where people had traveled abroad. Monkeypox, a viral infection that causes skin lesions, is endemic in certain parts of Africa, but the current outbreak has hit countries where the virus does not usually spread, sparking concern. The CDC also said there's been reports of transmission among family members and close contacts. We also heard worldwide about close contacts like close household members who through, for example, shared bedding or towels, have acquired infection. So it's not just through close intimate contact that this is being spread. So I have a couple big articles in my bonus section, which you can read online, which I'll give you a link to at the end of the show, if you'd like more about monkeypox. Okay, well, I have a few COVID stories. As you might notice, in 2.5 years since this pandemic has started, this is the farthest, latest in the show that it's ever been. Being a little deprioritized, it's still a thing, but there's a lot going on. First up from MedPage Today, second COVID booster protected seniors in long-term care. A fourth dose or second booster of Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine protected seniors living in long-term care from the most severe outcomes during the Omicron wave, despite showing a more limited effect against infection, according to prospective data from Israel. Among over 40,000 residents, effectiveness of a fourth dose versus a third given at least 4 months prior was about two-thirds effective against hospitalizations and mild or moderate severe illness, and 72% against COVID-19-related deaths, reported Kitam Musan of Tel Aviv University in Israel. The study was conducted from January to March 2022, when Omicron was the predominant strain, and protection against infection from the highly contagious variant was just 34%. And that's not even the more contagious subvariants that's running around the U.S. now. But the good news is that there's a lot of protection from additional shots. The bad news may be this. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. 1 in 5 U.S. adults experience COVID-19 symptoms 3 months after infection. A new survey of U.S. adults shows 1 in 5 have experienced lingering symptoms of COVID-19 that have persisted for at least 3 months, suggesting long COVID is a common phenomenon after acute infection. The survey was conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau this month, and results were analyzed by the CDC. 40% of those polled said they had been infected with COVID-19, with 1 in 13 of all U.S. adults experienced long COVID symptoms at the time they were surveyed. That's at the time they were surveyed. So currently, 1 in 13 Americans report experiencing long COVID symptoms. These symptoms can include brain fog, headache, and muscle pain. Next up, a story documenting how many lives were saved by COVID vaccines. This from Stat News. COVID-19 vaccines prevented nearly 20 million deaths in a year, study estimates. COVID-19 vaccines cut the potential global death toll by more than half in the first year they were available, according to a study published in The Lancet Infectious Diseases. The study modeled the spread of the disease in 185 territories and countries and found that without COVID vaccines, 31.4 million people would have died of the disease between December 2020 and 2021. While the pandemic was taking a devastating toll around the globe, with more than 3.5 million deaths since the first vaccine was administered in December 2020, the study estimated that vaccinations also prevented 19.8 million deaths, about 63% of the potential deaths. We knew it was going to be a large number, but I did not think it would be as high as 20 million deaths during just the first year, said Oliver Watson, a fellow at the Imperial College London and London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and co-first author on the study. However, millions more deaths could have been prevented. The team found that 1 in 5 deaths that occurred due to COVID-19 in low-income countries could have been prevented if the World Health Organization's global vaccine targets had been met. And in another story on the large effect COVID-19's had on the global population, this from Euroweekly News, global life expectancy falls due to COVID for first time since the 1950s. Global life expectancy has fallen 1.6 years due to the COVID pandemic, according to the latest analysis published by the One Campaign. The fall of 1.6 years comes between 2019 and 2021, with the One Campaign warning that a worsening of the situation may well be caused by a global food security crisis as well as climate change. Records of global life expectancy began in 1950, making this the first time the rate has fallen since records have been kept. Okay, well, now is time for the local Lucas County COVID-19 update. We still remain in the medium category from the CDC, although, of course, that's based on case rates that if they were 50% higher would put us in the high category, and the underreporting of cases is so high you can argue about the meaning of whether it's high or medium. So, well, in Lucas County, we did see a decline in their reported cases down to 62 a day from 87 the previous week. Although testing rates are pretty low, and obviously the underreporting of total number of cases is probably 10 times more the actual cases from what's reported. Testing positivity rates have seemed to decline, but again, this is coming in so late. It's actually hard. I'm going to have to reconsider even having a weekly local update because it's hard to even get weekly updates. The data is so slow coming in. It lags a lot, and they don't sync up with a week. They vary by, a week. I think things take 7 to 10 days to actually be reported. And the Ohio Department of Health has been reporting less and less. I've had to go to CDC sources in order to get state and local data. But according to the CDC data that's most recent, it does look like the testing positivity rates have gone down in Lucas County to about 8% from over 12% before. So that could be a good sign. Testing levels are pretty low in the U.S., but they're not as low as they've been in the U.S. The U.S. as a whole has set a new record low in testing, excluding the very first few weeks or so of the pandemic when testing was extremely limited. But now that testing is widespread, there's a lot of home testing, but stuff that's officially reported has reached a new low. And the volume of testing is only about a half of what it was just a few weeks ago. And the U.S. positivity rate has jumped up a little bit to 14.2% from 13.6% the previous week. And Ohio's positivity rate, if you can believe the more recent data, dropped a hair from about 14% to 12 or 13%. Again, the lag in data is so much that it's hard to even kind of tell what the current status is. But we are seeing the BA4 and the BA5 rising in both all parts of the country. So that expects it, you know, that's going to be the majority of cases in a matter of weeks. Nursing home active cases went up slightly to 82 from 80 the previous week. We had no more reported deaths from nursing homes from COVID in the most recent week. Hospitalizations from COVID in the U.S. are rising slowly, and the death rates nationally are hovering over 300 per day. It seems to be pretty stubbornly hitting in that area between 300 and 375 deaths a day. The bottom line for me is I will continue to wear a mask in indoor public spaces in Lucas County.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, next up we have Advisory Committee backs enhanced flu vaccine for seniors. This from MedPage Today. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices unanimously endorsed a group of influenza vaccines thought to provide better protection for older adults. By a vote of 15-0, the advisory committee recommended that adults 65 and over preferentially receive a quadrivalent vaccine over a standard influenza vaccine. Older adults are at risk of severe illness, hospitalization, and death from influenza, but the vaccines are frequently less effective in this population, explained Dr. Lisa Grofskopf of the CDC's influenza division. Based on current usage in this older population, approximately 2,000 additional deaths would be prevented with enhanced flu vaccines, Grofskopf noted, with an additional 400 deaths prevented if 100% of adults 65 and older receive the higher dose of enhanced vaccines. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch gears a bit and do a story that really is a stunning example of patriarchy in healthcare. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Gender bias may affect acceptance of antibiotic stewardship efforts. A single-center study suggests gender bias may play a role in whether antibiotic stewardship recommendations by pharmacists are accepted by hospitalists, researchers reported in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology. After adjusting for patient characteristics, pharmacists' gender remained significantly associated with whether recommended changes were accepted. Very significant. 90% less likely that a woman pharmacist's recommendation would be accepted. And whether the intervention resulted in antibiotic change, that was an 85% reduction. Yikes. The study authors say that while the findings need to be confirmed in larger studies, the implication that gender bias may play a role in whether physicians accept antibiotic stewardship recommendations could have, quote, profound effects on whether antibiotic stewardship interventions reach patients and improve their outcomes, and could also affect other pharmacy-led interventions. They also note that women make up 56% of clinical pharmacists, and the number has been growing. I just have to say, it's long overdue. It's time to listen to women.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, I want to close this episode's regular reporting with a story from Science Daily on some new recommendations or updated recommendations. New safe sleep guidelines aim to reduce infant deaths. The American Academy of Pediatrics has updated its safe sleep guidelines for infants for the first time in more than 5 years, emphasizing that babies should sleep on their backs on flat level surfaces to reduce their risk of sudden unexpected infant death syndrome, or SIDS. It's estimated that there are 3,500 sleep-related infant deaths in the United States each year. Many of these deaths are preventable, and the authors of the new guidelines are urging parents to take simple steps to help keep their children safe. The United States made great progress in preventing infant deaths during the 1990s after a public education campaign urged parents to put their babies to sleep on their backs. But the decline in deaths has been stalled for more than 20 years. Safe sleep experts say more can be done and hope the new guidelines spur fresh action. The recommendations published in the scientific journal Pediatrics include: babies should sleep on their back on a firm, flat, non-inclined surface free of soft goods such as blankets and toys. These items, while appealing to many parents, can pose suffocation hazards. The sleep surface should, at minimum, comply with all federal safety standards. Any inclined surfaces, including car seats, strollers, infant carriers, and infant slings, should be avoided for routine sleeping, especially for infants younger than 4 months. Swaddling has not been shown to reduce the risk of SIDS. If babies are swaddled, they should always be placed on their back. Weighted swaddles or weighted objects within swaddles are unsafe. Swaddling should be stopped when a baby starts trying to roll over, usually at 3 or 4 months or earlier, as a swaddle can pose a suffocation hazard. Parents should avoid devices marketed to reduce the risk of SIDS or other sleep-related deaths. There is no evidence for such claims, and they may lull parents into a false sense of security. While there is no contraindication to using home cardiorespiratory monitors or wearable monitors, there is no evidence that using them will prevent SIDS. Families who decide to use these monitors should still follow the safe sleep guidelines. Parents should sleep in the same room as the baby, but not in the same bed. Okay, well, now we're up to the part of the show, bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online. Just like all the stories I reported on in this episode, I'll give you the link at the end of the list. Got 24 bonus articles this week. First up, 18 ways the Supreme Court just changed America. This takes a commentary from 18 different people from a wide variety of perspectives on what the Supreme Court reversal of Roe versus Wade will mean for America. Two, five things to know now that the Supreme Court has overturned Roe versus Wade. This is a good primer if you're still, your head's reeling a bit. This is a good one to kind of straighten it out there. Three, global access to abortion still highly unequal. Of course, we've vaulted backwards as far as our place in the world with abortion healthcare access, but it is very unequal around the world. 4. Abortion pills will change a post-Roe world. Abortion pills will prove to be an important part in the post-Roe world, but we've got a couple more articles that get at how that's going to be difficult. 5. Red states crack down on abortion pills. 6. Abortion pills over the counter. Experts see big hurdles in widening U.S. access. So this is specifically talking about making abortion pills over the counter versus by prescription. And that could happen, but there's a lot of hurdles in the way for that. 7. The quote, abortion pill may treat dozens of diseases, but Roe reversal might upend research. Mifepristone, the FDA-approved abortion drug, might also treat conditions like cancer and PTSD. Proving it works in a post-Roe landscape could be a challenge. 8. Black people in the U.S. are twice as likely to face coercion and unconsented procedures during birth. 9. HIPAA medical privacy law won't protect you if prosecutors want your reproductive health records. 10. A major problem for minors, post-Roe access to abortion. 11. Primary care providers can help safeguard abortion. So this is a really important one. Abortion is not actually that complicated of a procedure, and it could be provided by primary care providers, but only an extremely small proportion of primary care providers actually provide that now. So that's a real opportunity for expansion of access to abortion care. 12. Women less likely than men to get authorship on scientific publications, analysis finds. Just another example of patriarchy in our society. And getting to some racism in society. 13. Black doctors are forced out of training programs at far higher rates than white residents. And related to that, 14. What will it take to level the playing field for black medical residents? 15. Digital backdoors can lead down the path to health inequity. So I've reported on this a lot in the past. This basically gets at the fact that you got different data and algorithms that are being used to guide patient care. And the fact that you have garbage in gets garbage out. If you have racist algorithms and your data is collected in a racist fashion, you will continue and reinforce those problems. And a little broader point, but related, 16, hold science to higher standards on racism. Science likes to think it's beyond racism. Not true. 17, racism is a major driver of environmental inequality, but most Americans incorrectly think it's poverty. 18, research on gun violence has been thwarted. It is now more urgent than ever. 19, 5 COVID numbers that don't make sense anymore. This is my only COVID story in 24 bonus. There you go. That's a change and perhaps an indication that COVID is being subsumed by other issues. 20, World Mental Health Report, Transforming Mental Health Care for All. This is a World Health Organization report. Very detailed. Is a great primer if you're trying to understand the systems in healthcare and society that lead to better or worse mental health report. Great report to read. Good resource. 21. COVID, conflict, and climate are fueling a global food crisis. Leaders must act fast. There are tens of millions of people that are moving into the starvation category if we don't act fast. 22. As promised, a couple stories on monkeypox. Monkeypox is not a public health emergency of international concern, so says the World Health Organization, but perhaps it should be. So this is a really good epidemiological overview of monkeypox and a listing of some of the concerns. 23, related to that, America may soon have another sexually transmitted infection, and that would be monkeypox. Now, it's could be transmitted other than through sexual contact, but sexual contact is traditionally very close contact, which is ideal for transmitting monkeypox. 24. This is one for this summer. Coming up, some parents skip steps to minimize firework risk to kids. So this is a really good overview of the things you should be looking out for using fireworks safely with kids. You can read these 24 bonus articles or any of the articles in this episode, or actually re-listen to this episode or any other episode, or look at hundreds of other articles on public health that have been cataloged and archived. You can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.